For those of you who like titles, the title of this sermon is The God Who Sees. The God Who Sees. I'd like to tell you a true story. It happened in 1964, or it could have been in the beginning of 1965. There was a young lady who was in the military. She was from Texas, and but in the military, she met a man who was a Native American, and they got married, and they had a child pretty quickly. And then he was sent overseas, and for whatever reason, she couldn't go with him, and the child couldn't go with him. So he said, well, you can go to the reservation and stay with my family and extended family. And she was not very keen on that situation, but she really didn't have any other choice, and so she went. Not much time went by, and the abuse began. And she was warned that she better not leave or even try to go off the reservation and tell anybody, or, you know, she would just disappear. And nobody would know the difference, or nobody would know where she was, and that the reservation police wouldn't help her, but they would cover anything that these people did. So she was in a horrible situation with a little baby, and she did sneak out one night in the middle of the night, early morning hours, bundled up the child, and walked several miles to a gas station that had a phone booth. Of course, the gas station was closed and all, and she made a phone call to the one person that she thought might could rescue her. And she made a call back to Texas, and it was to her brother, and she only had so much change for the long-distance call, and knowing that the clock was ticking, she had to tell him real fast what was going on and seek whether or not he could help her and come up to South Dakota and rescue her. And he was a church member of the Radio Church of God, and was married, and he had three little kids, and he took the call at 2 o'clock in the morning, and, I mean, it must be something serious to get a call at that time of day. And they spoke and ended up with that he would try to be there on a certain day, which was only a few days away, and if she could get back somehow to that gas station. And there were some outbuildings there that were deserted, and she said she could hide there for a while, because as soon as the morning came and they knew she was gone, there'd be a mad search for her, and it wouldn't be pleasant if they found her. And so they decided on the date, and he would try to get there and rescue her. So the man in the church, he didn't waste any time. He started packing his car right then. That morning and in the night, and began his trek up to South Dakota. And on his way, he stopped a few times to call the South Dakota Highway Patrol and then the county that was next to the reservation to see if they could help. And they told him what his sister had told him, that they don't have any jurisdiction on the reservation, and they probably can't help. And they said that's what they said. We can't help you. Good luck. We admire what you're trying to do, but we don't have any jurisdiction. Well, when he got close to the reservation, he stopped and he pleaded with the sheriffs if there was anything that they could do to help. And they said, look, you're on your own. We can't go in there and try to help or anything. And if we call the police on the reservation, that would just put her in danger too. The best we can do is I can send two patrol cars to right at the border, and if you do get through, then we'll block the road if there's anybody pursuing you. So he thanked them for doing that, and the day came. She was able to sneak away that in the middle of the night and get to that gas station, and she was hiding in one of the outbuildings, hoping that, but not knowing, because there's no cell phone back then to know for sure, hoping that her brother would somehow get there. And As it worked out, he did get there. It wasn't early in the morning, but it was midday. And as he pulled around the back of the gas station, she came running out carrying the baby in a bag of clothes. I jumped in the car, and then they took off. Just driving the speed limit, trying not to draw attention and everything. But since there was already a search for her, they noticed her getting in the car, and a pursuit began. And it eventually was a high-speed pursuit with Indian Reservation police and other vehicles chasing them. And so they were 20 or so miles from the border. And the church member, obviously, he ignored the laws of the reservation and he ignored the speed limit. And for some reason, they never closed the gap. I don't know. I can only speculate, like you can, why they couldn't seem to close the gap. And anyway, as they got close to the reservation border, this church member could see the police cars on the shoulders. And as he blew through the border, they pulled across the road and they blocked it, and those in pursuit had to turn and go back. Anyway, they drove through the night heading back towards Texas, and this woman says that the daughter of the church member said that she woke up and they were in a parking lot, and something strange was going on. Women dressed in nice dresses and men in suits and ties and carrying briefcases, and little children all dressed up nice were walking up to this building. And her brother said, here's the dress, and I don't know, I've heard the story a couple of different ways, that one that he brought it from his wife and another one that he told her to get to bring a dress or something. But either, anyway, he said, we're going to church. And it was the Sabbath morning, and I think they were somewhere in Oklahoma. So things did work out. You know, from time to time, we experience great challenges, don't we? Unusual events. In fairness, some are good, and some are bad, and some are somewhere in between. It seems life comes with uncertain and unclear choices. It comes with persecutions, and at times, extended periods of grief and fear and anxiety. The good things that happen to us, we may shout from the rooftops. However, other things that happen to us, we may keep close. For some, because of the nature of the issue, maybe betrayal or victimizing, you've chosen to suffer and to heal in silence. Testing that comes upon us impacts us in length and severity. And some of these things have no respect for children or for the aged. Whether good things or bad things, physical, emotional, they all have spiritual elements, at least to the Christian. And this can also extend to our children, who are also, in many cases, are led by God's Spirit. So there is a name for God that's, my understanding, it's used only one time in the Scriptures, and that's in Genesis chapter 16. That name is El Roi, and it means the God who sees, the God who is paying attention. It means the God who cares so much that he comes and deals with us personally. Now, angels are ministering spirits sent forth to minister for those who will inherit salvation. We read that in Hebrews chapter 1. Angels have a role sometimes. However, it is the God who sees who comes to us to bring his comfort, his mind, thoughts, and judgment into our innermost being. It's not angels. God reserves this important, intimate, and spiritual relationship for himself. Such is how the mind and thinking of God comes to displace our own feeble, problematic thinking, and I call our thinking, well, at least I call my own thinking, stinking thinking, because we just are not where God is. I'd like to quote Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good for those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. So verses like this can and should add solace during times of distress and high anxiety. And, you know, I thought, you know, we were supposed to ride on the high hills and our enemies are supposed to run from us, not chase us all the way to the border. Well, you know, one way to better understand Romans 8, verse 28, and other scriptures like what James says when he says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. One way to better understand things like this, when we know life is full of challenges and trials and tribulations, and occasionally some really great things, one of the ways that we can better understand is to investigate a part of the sacrificial system given to ancient Israel. Now, those sacrifices were shadows of things to come, symbols of spiritual principles, shadows of spiritual realities, and it says, but the substances of Christ or belongs to Christ. They picture multiple things that Christ does and is. Now, could something as colossal as Christ working to develop himself in us be left out of the sacrificial system and the symbols that are there? I think not. That is what it looks like, a box of salt. And salt actually has something to do with the magnificent meaning behind Romans chapter 8, 28, and James 1, 2, about things working out for the good. Now, how important is salt to you? Well, we have to have a certain amount to live, and without salt, we would die. Generally, there is enough salt in our food that we don't need to add any, but a lot of us, like myself, we do like to add salt to enhance the flavor. I have a little bit of food with my salt. And how valuable is salt? You know, it has a great many uses in cooking, canning, preserving meat, etc. But did you know that today less than 5% of the salt that is used for food or in the area of food? From ancient times to present, the importance of salt to humans and animals has been recognized. Thousands of years ago, animals created paths, trails, to salt licks, and men would follow them seeking game, as well as the salt. These trails sometimes became roads, and beside those roads, sometimes settlements grew up, all because of a salt trail or a path to a salt lick. In fact, Venice, Italy is one such settlement. We're going to look at the subject of salt today and its significance for our spiritual development. Now, salt has a very interesting history. In times past, salt was a very sought after, and it was a rare commodity. Roman soldiers were sometimes paid in salt, and it's where we get the word salary. It's where it comes from. Every cell in the body contains salt. An adult's body contains about half a pound, or about half this box of salt in your body right now. At one time, salt bars were the standard currency of Ethiopia. And as to the brain, sodium is a key element in the operation of all signals within it. And without salt, I couldn't speak to you and you couldn't hear. And it make any sense. I don't know. It may still not make any sense. I should have thought about that before I put that down there. Anyway, in the 6th century, Moorish merchants routinely traded salt for gold and vice versa. The exchange rate was 1 ounce of salt for 1 ounce of gold. However you look at it, that box of salt, I guess if I could go back in time, would be worth about $50,000 worth of gold. Anyway, apparently we use salt in more than 14,000 different ways, from making products like plastics, paper, glass, polyester, rubber, and fertilizers to household bleaches, soaps, detergents, and dyes. Everyone uses salt, directly or indirectly. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 5. And verse 13, probably one of the most notable scriptures about salt in the Bible. Christ says, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how can it season anything? And it's really good for nothing, and something that can be trampled underfoot. You know, we might think we kind of have a general idea, and maybe we do have a notion of what this really means and all, but let's assume that there is a lot more to the full significance of what Christ is giving us here in this directive. Salt, for multiple reasons, has found its way into our language and common phrases. He or she is not worth their salt. You know, they're not worth the wages they're being paid. She or he is the salt of the earth, meaning they are genuine, honorable, and valuable. People say these things. Last week I was on the phone with my wife, Debbie, and she said that very thing about a woman in the church, in the congregation here, that she was of the salt of the earth. And I won't say her name. It doesn't matter. She's moving away in a day or two anyway. Now, this concept or symbolism does not come to us from a 20th century or a 21st century Genesis. It's very ancient, and despite having its origins thousands of years ago, it was so prominent a concept it lasted well into the 1800s. Even today, many traces, or at least small traces anyway, of its concepts are still with us, but few really understand why. Not surprising, we find some interesting things about salt listed in the scriptures. Come with me to Ezra chapter 6. Ezra chapter 6. Ezra chapter 6, we're going to look at verses 9 and 10. Verses 9 and 10 of Ezra chapter 6. And whatever they need, young bulls, rams, and lambs for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, and oil, according to the requests of the priests who are in Jerusalem, let it be given to them day by day without fail, that they may offer sacrifices of a sweet aroma to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. So, you know, Ezra was being sent to reestablish the temple, its offerings, and worship. And something here is curious. The King Darius is following the decree of King Cyrus, which was a concern about these things that were needed for the sacrifices, one of which was salt. It was serious to those kings, those Persian kings, that whatever the recipe was to please the God of heaven, that it would be done completely and nothing left out. They wanted God's favor to be on them and their kingdoms. You see, these kings had seen the great power of God, and they wanted sacrifices to be offered on their behalf as well. So they wanted to make sure that whether it was Zerubbabel and Joshua or it was Ezra and Nehemiah going back, they wanted to make sure that they had what was necessary. Let's go over a page to Ezra chapter 7 and look at verses 21 and 22. Ezra chapter 7 and verse 21, And I, Artaxerxes, the king, do issue a decree to all the treasurers who are in the region beyond the river, that whatever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, may require of you, let it be done diligently, up to 100 talents of silver, 100 cores of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of oil, and salt without prescribed limit. Salt without limit. So Artaxerxes, he felt the same way that the other kings felt. You know, Artaxerxes, I think he was the fourth son of Xerxes who was married to Esther. Sometimes I get those, I don't keep good track of all those kings, but I think that's the case. In any event, he would have known Esther. And we're told that Ezra was to receive this very valuable salt without measure. And we really want to get to the question of why. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 43 as we continue to look into this. Ezekiel chapter 43 and verse 18. And he said to me, Son of man, thus says the Lord God, these are the ordinances for the altar on the day when it is made, for sacrificing burnt offerings on it and for sprinkling blood on it. Let's drop down to verse 23 and read verse 23 and 24. When you have finished cleansing it, you shall offer a young bull without blemish and a ram from the flock without blemish. When you offer them before the Lord, the priest shall throw salt on them. And they will offer them up as a burnt offering to the Lord. The offerings were to be made only after being sprinkled with salt. Unless they were sprinkled with salt, they were not acceptable to God. Typically, the offering would be sprinkled with salt just before or while it was being roasted with fire. And again, the why is vitally important to your well-being and to my well-being. Let's go back to Leviticus chapter 2. Leviticus chapter 2. And verse 13. Leviticus chapter 2. And verse 13. In every offering of your grain offering, you shall season with salt, and you shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. And then it says, with all your offerings, you shall offer salt. Interesting, all of them. So we see here again that that salt is required with the offerings, and we see here that it's with the grain offerings and the meal offerings. But it also says, with all of your offerings. Perhaps we could conclude that because salt was valuable, like a fine bull or a goat, that God wanted them to give some of that too. Maybe to show their sincerity or something. But something else is mentioned here that should not escape our attention, and that is that there is a salt of the covenant. Let's go to 2 Chronicles. Second Chronicles, my Bible is coming apart. Second Chronicles chapter 13 and verse 5. Verse 5, should you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave the dominion over Israel to David forever to him and his sons by a covenant of salt? By a covenant of salt. So here is another place where we see the covenant of salt is mentioned. The Davidic throne was made binding by a covenant of salt. The James Moffat translation says, God gave it to David and his descendants by an irrevocable pledge. Other translations say perpetual covenant. So God's promise is reliable and you can count on it. I think it was Paul who said there in Philippians, being confident of this thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it. That type of thing. If God says it and you were baptized, he's going to complete a work. Now let's go to Numbers chapter 18. Numbers chapter 18. Numbers 18 and verse 19. All the heave offerings of the holy things which the children of Israel offer to the Lord, I have given to you, he's talking to the Levites, I have given to you and your sons, and the daughters with you as an ordinance forever, and it's a covenant of salt forever before the Lord with you and your descendants with you. And those are talking about offerings that were that the Levites got a portion of, mostly tithes and first fruit type offering, almsgiving, that type of thing. And God made that agreement, that promise to the Levites by a covenant of salt, a perpetual covenant. You know, there was a custom of that day whereby a covenant or an agreement, a deal perhaps, a contract for perhaps land or cattle, or some business relationship, in order to bind that firmly, a meal would be shared by those that were involved. And they would eat the meal, sprinkling it with salt. It had to have salt. Now, customs die hard even when the meaning becomes lost. Because even today, in the world of mergers and acquisitions, there is often a meal. Sometimes several are arranged, as the sides entertain an offer and consider whether or not they can, you know, get along, whether they have similar management cultures and that type of thing. And then if the deal is done, there's usually another meal. And while the depth of meaning may have been lost, for some reason the meal has remained to this day for some reason. Now, what was it that was behind a custom so strong and meaningful, so important, that traces of it, or you could say shadows of it, still continue to this day? Well, salt has the ability to preserve things. That's true. It preserves things like meat and like leather and tanning. It also is a symbol of purity and hospitality and friendship. When pure, it is able to preserve. The reasoning was that eating with salt or a covenant of salt would symbolize the pure intentions of each party, and that the agreement was entered into with integrity, and each party would preserve the agreement intact. And God used this symbolism when he prescribed how the offerings were to be done. Salt was required because the offerings were to be pure, with integrity, physically perfect, males of the first year, which meant entering their prime. All aspects of the offering prefigured aspects of Christ and his work, including the work that he's doing in each of us. As to the notable events in our lives, be they wonderful things or be they trials and tribulations, they have a place in us being living sacrifices unto Christ. In our life journey, we are more and more a proper and pure sacrifice. I'm saying that there is progress being made. And we are on a path to resemble Christ with our thoughts, our love, and judgments. Life events build and test our character, reveal fruits, decision-making processes, tongue control, sensitivities in our approach, and courage too. Each of us is in a creative process managed and directed by the God who sees, and he is personally involved in that process. Come with me to Isaiah chapter 45. Isaiah 45. Look at a number of scriptures from verse 5 through 9 here, Isaiah 45. We'll start here in verse 5. And I am the Lord, there is no other. There is no God besides me. I will gird you, though you have not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun to its setting that there is none besides me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace, and I create calamity. I, the Lord, do all these things. Rain down, you heavens, from above, and let the skies pour down righteousness. Let the earth open, let them bring forth salvation, and let righteousness spring up together. I, the Lord, have created it. Woe to him who strives with his maker, Let the potsherd strive with the potsherd of the earth. Shall the clay say to him who forms it, what are you making? Or shall your handiwork say, he has no hands? Okay, let's think about what is being said here. First of all, God created the conditions that make possible calamity. He created the conditions. He has also entrusted us with the events of our lives, good and bad. This is important. You know, self-sufficiency is just an illusion, and I think, you know, you've been around very long and you realize how true that is. You and I are not very good at perfectly navigating most of our trials and stresses in a perfectly godly way. We fail, we blunder, and we embarrass ourselves. And it doesn't matter who we are, little education or more degrees than a thermometer, we're the problem. We're the problem. It doesn't matter. So we'd like to be patient, but still be decisive. We can't get those together perfectly. We'd like to be stronger while more humble, compassionate while more logical, happy, fun, and still responsible. We have a lot of things to put together in a more perfect way. It takes time to learn these things, and God gives us the space and the time to develop his character. He's shaping the clay and causing righteousness to spring up together with our errors. He's the master potter, and that which is being shaped doesn't tell the master potter what he should make. It should be the other way around, isn't it? And God is shaping us. And, you know, I'd like him to make me shape me into a really rich person, and I have a G5 or G8 plane and all that. He's not doing that. He's got a much better plan. That's mine's stinking thinking. As already mentioned, the sacrifices represented Jesus Christ and the ultimate sacrifice that he was to make for all mankind. The forgiveness of sin is what allows us to journey through this life and all these events, good and bad, and remain in God's good graces despite our sometimes lack of faith and sometimes sin. Often it's the trial or the event that reveals sin or triggers wrong attitudes. However, through the working of God's Spirit, we're left with an improved mind, a better judgment and resolve. It's the events that are so often the catalyst that we needed. When I was a child, there was five siblings, and my father died at a very young age, so I was 11 at the time. And obviously we went through some issues and stuff like that that were challenging, and you have your challenges. And so one time, very soon after Dad had died, it was Wednesday night, which was Bible study night, and we always went to Bible study and everything. And this time there was a Category 4 hurricane barreling in on Houston. Well, they never called to cancel Bible study, so we just assumed that we were having Bible study. And we didn't cancel church and Bible studies as much as we do nowadays. We were more careful, I think, or more prudent. Anyway, we were sitting there trying to eat a quick dinner before we would leave to go to Bible study. And my mother was saying, you know, it's they're saying that we're supposed to shelter and all of that, and I don't know if it's right if we should leave. And then finally she decided that we should get in the car and try to make it to Bible study. And we needed gas on the way, so we stopped to get gas. And just about the time the gas tank got filled, the winds really hit, and the roof of the gas station went flying across the street and down the road, and trees were falling in on the street and stuff. And Mom said, well, we got to get to Bible study. So she wove around the down trees and everything, and we got to Bible study, and then it was a packed house. Why wouldn't it be? It was only a Category 4. And we got home from Bible study, and a lot of trees were down in the yard, and the power was out, and Mom opened the front door, and we went in, and you could feel the glass under our feet right away, and she lit some candles, and we were amazed to see that table that we had been eating at, which was in front of a big sliding glass door, well, there was no more wind at that time, and the glass door had blown in, and that was before the things like tempered glass was required, and so glass didn't break into little bitty pieces. It was giant shards. And those shards were stuck in the walls all through the house. Now, it was an 800-square-foot house, so it didn't take a lot of shards to cover it. But it was down the hallways and stuck into any door that was closed. It would not have been the place to be during Bible study time. Now, I was like 12 years old. I think I got out of that. You know, if they're having Bible study, it's probably a good idea to go. Another time, we were on our way to church, and we were tooling along in our 72 Grand Torino station wagon with wood panels on the side. And the car died. It was on the highway, and the car died, and the lights went out on the dash. And my mother, all of her 95 pounds, was, you know, trying to turn the steering wheel without power steering and all back then. And she told us to start praying. And so she thought she was just going to coast over to the side of the road, but the car kept coasting. And it wasn't too far up there, and it was the exit we needed to go to church. It kept coasting. She kept steering. And we got off the freeway, and it kept coasting. It should have never coasted that far. It kept coasting, and as it was coasting up to the intersection there, the light turned green, and nobody was in front of her, so she, you know, turned that steering wheel and got turned, and it kept coasting, and then there was a big mall up there on the right, and my mom remembered that there was a Montgomery Ward's auto store there in that mall. It's on the other side of the mall and everything. I said, "We're going to go for it, kids." And she turned in, and it coasted up a big hill. Then it coasted around the outside of the mall, and it stopped coasting right in front of the auto repair place. And they fixed the car in about 30 minutes, and then we drove on to church, and we were a little late and had a nice story to tell, and I'm sure it encouraged a lot of people and everything. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, you know, we're getting really good gas mileage this way. Maybe we ought to do it this way all the time. You know, I've related a few stories to you, and hopefully they are helpful, but it's unlikely that they will impact you as much as they have me. And thus, you have your own crazy, awesome, and sometimes scary and painful experiences. You do. Come with me to Mark chapter 9. Mark chapter 9, and we're going to look at verses 49 and 50. For 49, "For everyone will be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt." We already learned that every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt. "Salt is good," verse 50, "but if the salt loses its flavor, how will you season it? Have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another." The King James Version says, "Everyone will be salted with fire." Christ is speaking to his disciples. We are his modern day disciples. We're living sacrifices unto God. Am I correct? We are. We are to be salted or seasoned with fire, just as every sacrifice was to be salted. Fire is the difficulty, the tragedies of life. It's even the good things that can be misused. Salt is the wonderful flavor that comes to our character. the godliness that solidifies in our nature that will never, ever go back to the weakness it had once been. And then again, we're told that if the salt loses its flavor, it isn't any good. In ancient times, when salt was so precious and was taxed so highly, it was not uncommon for salt to be delivered less than pure or mixed with other elements. In some extreme cases, all that was left was the residue of impure salt after the sodium chloride was washed out. This is salt that isn't salty any longer. That residue was commonly used to mix with animal dung and used as fertilizer. Christ said that it should be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. What it's talking about is that person who goes through many things but won't retain the lessons, won't take seriously their calling. They've rejected God's journey for them. They value less their calling. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4. First Peter chapter 4, and we're going to look at verses 12 and 13. 12 and 13. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trials, which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you. But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. We see again something about rejoicing in these experiences. I'm not saying in the discomfort that they bring and the fear that they bring, but in the advanced schooling that's going to pay off big time for us. God, through Peter, says, don't really be surprised by fiery trials and difficulties that they're going to come. Some of our own making and some of no fault of our own. Depending on multiple issues, they will impact us a little differently, too. You know, men, women, and children have different perspective. They're made differently by God. So it's to be appreciated and not fought. Typically, women's wells run deeper, and they feel deeper about some things, while men may feel deeper about other things. And I hope that we can become better at grasping one another's needs. Fiery trials result in a person being salted, developed, flavored, enhanced, and solidified in righteousness. Now, most in this world also go through great difficulties, but without learning the mind of God while going through it. They have giant problems, but their solutions probably make no sense to you. Why? Because God's thoughts are not man's thoughts, unless, of course, you're being salted by the God who sees. Let's go back to 1 Peter chapter 1. We're right here in 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning here in verse 6, and we're going to go through verse 9. Verse 6, 1 Peter chapter 1. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you've been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen you love, in other words, you love him even though you haven't seen him, though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. You know, I remember a very deep voice from many years ago. He used to say that the supreme pinnacle of God's creation is man. The supreme pinnacle of God's creation is man. And look at the vast universe and how big and how amazing it is. But the supreme pinnacle is man. It's a two-phase creation, though. Initially, there is the physical And then over time, the all-important finishing touches, which are spiritual in nature. And over this journey, the physical fades. You know, gravity and time and all has its effect on us physically. But the spiritual can still be vibrant and growing all through life. It is the salting by fire that actually preserves our life into eternity. Salt preserves. Every sacrifice had to be salted as a symbol that who it represented had true godly character. So as living sacrifices, we also are salted. We are developing the character of Christ. God puts us to the test, and our metal is both formed and tested during these times, and I include the good times as well. The very first scripture quoted was Romans 8, verse 28, about all things working together for good. Well, let's look at that area of scripture, but let's look at the context of the scripture. If you'll allow me to, I'd like to read it from the Amplified Bible. We're going to start in verse 25, though. Verse 25. But if we hope for what we do not see, let's think about that for just a second. If we hope for what we do not see, and the question we ought to all ask ourselves is, do we highly desire change? Do we highly desire putting on the mind of God, admitting that we don't have it totally, and that we need to put on the mind of God? But if we hope for what we do not see, and I'm assuming we do, we wait eagerly for it with patience and composure. So we recognize that challenges are going to come our way, and we also know what's going on with them, with composure. We accept how God does these things, and we go into trials with a winning attitude and not a woe is me one. Now, I'm in Florida most of the time right now, and thankfully I can go online and I can listen to the messages that y'all are hearing here. And I think it was Mr. Steve McNeely gave one a few weeks ago, and it was about embracing the challenge. Well, that's kind of what I'm saying. We know what God is doing with these things. It's not some empty trial we're going through and it's going to have no meaning. I think Mr. Flynn talked about his wrecked up ping pong table or something. It's quite hilarious and everything, and I could sympathize with what he had happened and all, because I did the same thing or something similar with a ping pong table before. The leverage is tremendous. You can really bend those legs, and you can eventually get it all right, and God is eventually getting us right. Verse 26, in the same way the Spirit comes to us and helps us in our weaknesses, we do not know what prayer to offer, or how to offer it as we should. Let's think about that. We've all been in that place before under serious trials. We did not know what for sure our prayer should be. But it says, the rest of that verse says that the Spirit knows our need and at the right time intercedes on our behalf with sighs and groanings too deep for words. Now, that's kind of heavy. What does that mean? Well, we often don't know our real needs as God sees them, nor do we know the needs of others. Going deeper, do we know the will of God respecting these things? Because it is that is the will of God, that will determine how our prayers will be answered, despite what we might be praying. What was it? I mean, Mr. Horchek gave a sermon. I think y'all saw it here, and we saw it last week in Orlando. And he said, and he was telling about the funny things that little kids say. And the little girl said something to a prayer to God and said, thank you for the little brother, but I prayed for a puppy. And, that's a lot of times what's going on. We have all this sincerity, and that is so wonderful and everything, but we don't really know. Verse 27 says, "And he who searches the hearts knows what the mind of the Spirit is." Now, Christ living in us knows the answer, or the answers to all those things, but we haven't developed enough, in most cases, to see things clearly yet. In part, we simply can't know, because God knows all the past intricacies and all the future and all of that. And then it says, because the Spirit intercedes before God on behalf of God's people in accordance to God's will. So we pray even with tears for ourselves, our families, and others, and God honors our sincerity. And yet, while our attitudes may be wonderful, we don't see everything as God sees it. And so our prayers, in a sense, go on in the background, though overshadowed by the part played by the Spirit of God. And then it says in verse 28, the one that we've quoted and looked at, "And we know with great confidence that God, who is deeply concerned about us, causes all things to work together as planned for good for those who love God, to those who are called according to his plan and his purpose. For those whom he foreknew and loved and chose, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of Christ." Not overnight, but as the time goes by, we're supposed to be like Christ. Christ was salted, I mean, in the sense that he had perfect character, and that's what we're growing in. It takes time. Goes on to say, "and ultimately share in his complete sanctification, so that he would be the firstborn, the most beloved and honored among many brethren and many believers." When that church member, his sister and her little boy, were speeding across the reservation with the reservation police and others in hot pursuit, what kind of spiritual battles and lessons were going on? I'm sure that church member did not want to be there, not be under that stress. And if caught, he might not even lived. It's certain that Satan wanted a different outcome. Well, you know, I wonder, what kind of earnest prayers were being offered up, and were they perfectly in tune with God's thoughts and will and all? Probably not. Just how was God's Spirit working? Well, I think angels were keeping the distance between them and the police. I mean, that wouldn't be hard, because God created physics, and I suppose he can suspend it at any time he wants to, and we call those miracles. He could have made their cars drop down to like 25 horsepower, and the church members' Fairlane 500 jump to 700 horsepower. I don't know. Would have been quite easy for God. What about the reservation laws? Truth is, a higher law was being worked out. Judgments were being made both by God and by the church member. Things were learned that would never be forgotten. I'd like to quote one last scripture, and that is Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, if I might. "Walk in wisdom towards those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt." All these experiences and all the wonderful character traits of God that you're putting on, seasoned with salt, "that you may know how you ought to answer each one." The salt that comes to us through God working in our life events is like wonderful seasoning, a delicious flavor. It's like an inspiring painter painting a wonderful melody, a beautiful sunset. It is God's handiwork, and it is very satisfying to him. And just as in the days of creation when he finished a work, what was it that he said? He said, "It is very good, very good." And he rested on the Sabbath day, I suppose, to take it all in and to set that day apart, as you know. It is totally reasonable to say that you are bringing joy and satisfaction to God. as you learn, as you humbly submit, as you struggle and fail even, but you are improving and taking on the mind of Christ. Something so special is happening, so wonderful and so sustaining is going on. Just as your prayers are sweet incense to God and your alms come up for a memorial before God, and they do. We love God and He loves us. How much does He love us? John 17, verse 23 says that He loves us even as He loves Christ. Read it for yourself. At a level that He loves Christ. You are the salt of the earth. It is through the character that you are developing that our Father is going to season the entire world. On a lighter note, I'd like to leave you with a few things of kind of interesting about salt. In 1952, a book on etiquette was written by Amy Vanderbilt of the famed Vanderbilt family. It was a guide to the social graces and describes good manners and the proper rules of etiquette. And she described how one would set a formal dinner table when you have guests. So the picture in the book, it was like a really long table. Maybe there was like 12 or 15 people or whatever it was, seats. And the host is at one head of, at the head of a table, I guess. They're very honored. The next most honored guest, or the most honored guest, would be at the other end of the table. The salt was to be placed in front of each of them. A salt by the host's end and a salt by the most honored guest. And then the rest of the people were supposed to be set, depending on their honor, their accomplishments and all, from there towards the center, so that the least accomplished salted individual would be the furthest from the salt. I kid you not. There was a recognition of the meaning of salt and being salted. It's not been that long ago that spilling or wasting salt was a bad omen or a sign of bad luck. So could you bring up that picture, please, for me? I can't see it. Is it up there yet? Is it there now? Okay, so you see the painting by Leonardo da Vinci of the Last Supper. There should be two sections there. One is a broad one that shows the whole painting. That was done in 1495, or around 1495. It took a while. On a convent in Milan, Italy. It was about 15 feet tall and about 29 feet long. When Leonardo da Vinci was painting the Last Supper, he actually used people to be the models, and he went out into the streets and, okay, I need somebody who I think looks like John or I think looks like whoever, and he would pick them and they'd bring them in and then he would paint them. In the scene that you see there. He did not choose to do it that way with Judas Iscariot, and he asked the authorities if he could go into the prison, and he wanted to see the worst, most horrible place in the prison, and that's where he picked out Judas Iscariot and brought him in, and he painted him. This person that was not to be honored. And really, if you think about, at least in Christendom, Judas Iscariot is the least liked person, probably. Now, I don't know if you can tell or not, but that one inset that's a little bit larger to the one side, I guess I should have a picture here. There's a woman, maybe Mary, I don't know, on the far right, and then there's a man with a beard and whiter hair. I'm not sure who he is. And then the next one, which has some brown hair or reddish hair, that's Judas Iscariot. And if you look at his hand, what would be his right hand, he's grasping the money bag, right? He's grasping the money bag. And if you look at that same wrist, he's knocked over the salt. Do you see that? Now, that was entirely intended to show his reckless regard for righteousness. Leonardo da Vinci knew what that meaning was. Yeah, few people have had so many think so poorly of them as Judas Iscariot. And the symbol of salt carelessly knocked over, everyone in those times understood. Judas Iscariot was the opposite of goodness, the opposite of salted. See? Well, let's remember the importance of salt. The symbolism is beautiful, for it is the character of God. May there be salt between us, and may you be worth your salt.